This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Cameron Deason Hammond was a spiritually curious kid. Although her family wasn't religious, she often tagged along with a friend to synagogue and was enamored with the ritualism of the space, robes and chanting. As an adult, she followed that desire all the way to a Christian evangelical megachurch. She became a music minister, a worship leader, and an overseas missionary. In her new book, Cameron documents how being part of that community forced her to confront a tension, one between her feminism and her faith. She also traces how evangelism made her rethink her relationship with sex, love, and her own body. Cameron Deason Hammond is a musician and the author of the new book, This Is My Body, a memoir of religious and romantic obsession. She's in North Carolina on book tour, and she joins us as part of our ongoing series, Embodied. Cameron, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I've been loving reading through your book, and I love the way that you kind of take us into the mind of someone coming to understand spirituality and the role that that can play in their life. And I'd love for you to kind of explain how that curiosity first began for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just a very spiritually curious kid. I much later, a friend would tell me that I'm a super spook, someone who just was always interested in the unseen, in mystery, in magic, and that kind of manifested first for me in just being very drawn to religious practice because it was just different from my family. We were not religious, and so it always felt very special and very other. And, you know, even the exclusivity of religious spaces felt exciting to me. You know, that I was an outsider always looking in kind of drove me to pursue that as I got older.
How did you end up joining a evangelical community in New York City? Tell me a bit about those, the people you met and how you got involved with that community.
I was a musician. I was making my first album and I just kind of graduated from college and was in those first few years post-college when one can feel kind of lost, and I certainly did. And I met a group of artists, writers, actors, thinkers, musicians who were part of a church that was planted from a big evangelical church in England. So it was not like what one would think of as an evangelical church in America. It was very social justice focused. It was very egalitarian, both women and men led. But what really drew me to this community was the way that they were just living their lives, you know, in a way that was supportive of each other as artists. So, you know, artists can be very competitive, and my experience was that it was a competitive kind of environment when I was making a record and trying to get a record deal. And it was really the first time that I was around people that, you know, were inviting me into their homes and feeding me. And, you know, we were all young and poor, but we were, you know, having meals in each other's houses. And so it was community that really drew me in at first. And also just that lifelong kind of spiritual seeking that I had been doing, I thought, well, this must be the thing I've been looking for all this time. It wasn't until later when I moved to Texas, you know, so I, you know, at 25, like had this whole conversion experience where I felt that I had to change everything about my life, and that included leaving New York. So it wasn't until I got to Texas that I experienced sort of what we think of as mega church culture. It was very different than the community I was a part of in New York.
One of the things that really is interesting to me about your story that intersects with the series that we're doing, looking at kind of our relationship with our bodies and how that connects to all these other facets of our life, is that you had an STD and getting that diagnosis was actually a big driver to your conversion. Can you talk about that and that connection?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so interesting now. I mean, so I was diagnosed with HPV, human papillomavirus, which is very common now. You know, there's a vaccine for it. I have a 13-year-old daughter who's been, you know, vaccinated for it. But at the time, you know, this was almost 20 years ago, it was new. You know, my OB said something to me about, you know, this is the scourge of your generation. I mean, this is just a doctor saying this to me. And so I just kind of spiraled into this incredible amount of sexual shame just around, you know, this experience of getting this STI. And, you know, it was really the first time that I saw my body as vulnerable. I mean, when we're young, you know, very often, like, we think we're invincible. I thought I was invincible. And it reoriented me in a way toward my body that wasn't positive, you know. You know, I wish I could go back and talk to that 25-year-old and say, like, it's okay, you know, it's okay, you're okay. But I felt like because of this experience, I had to completely recalibrate my relationship to sex. I had to find a way to live in the world as a sexual being that was not going to cause harm to me or to other people. You know, and of course, I think of sort of the singular obsession of evangelical Christianity is erotic virtue, right? Mm. So, you know, rules and structure around erotic relationships, sexual relationships is a huge part of evangelical Christianity, of Christianity, but specifically American Western Protestantism. So I was sort of ready-made for, I guess, what we could sometimes now think of as purity culture, you know, this idea that sex is exclusively made for inside of marriage and marriage only. So that experience with the STI set me up, you know, just kind of to walk right into that culture.
So when you entered the church, you had been obviously a sexually active person in your 20s in New York. You converted. You kind of had this born again virginity, as you describe it in the book. As you entered that space, did that feel empowering as an identity for you, or what was kind of your own narrative around your sexuality at that point?
That's a great question. I think it did feel empowering at first. A good friend of mine in my church in New York did this thing with me. She put me on what she called a man fast, where I was meant to fast interactions with men that were romantic in any way. And this went all the way from, you know, not accepting a date with someone to not making eye contact with someone on the subway. Because in her mind, it would free me to focus on God, to focus on myself, to focus on God. And it did. It did in a way. What it did for me was it showed me how much I was relying on the energy I got from those interactions, how distracting it was for me. So, at first it absolutely was, I think, empowering. And I think, I mean, in the way that, you know, people go on extreme diets, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you cut out an entire thing, an entire group of food or an entire part of yourself, it limits your choices. It makes life a little bit more simple. And for me, because I felt that I felt in crisis, it did sort of simplify and allow me to focus. But what happens, I think, in, you know, this born again virginity thing, or it happened for me, is that the narrative that you play in your mind, that you tell yourself that, you know, sexuality is bad, that, you know, having, you know, sex with someone is bad, being in a sex relationship was bad, you know, even if it's a loving relationship, that narrative, you can't shut it off. So I brought that with me into my marriage. And I know that a lot of people who have been in this culture have experienced that. And that is one of the real kind of heartbreaking things about it, I think, is that, you know, you can't stop playing that tape once it's started.
You're expressing so much vulnerability in how openly you share that narrative and how openly you kind of talk about these tensions within the church in your book. And I'm wondering for you now that you're a little bit more removed from that space, do you think that there is an element of that culture that is preying on people's vulnerabilities, or do you feel like there is actually more agency of the individuals that we don't really see? How do you see kind of the role of vulnerability within the evangelical church from your standpoint now?
I mean, I don't think, you know, I think we're living in a time where the word vulnerability or the word vulnerable is so often used. And I think that's a good thing for the most part. But from my experience inside evangelical, you know, communities, vulnerability is the very last thing that is happening. And that is because, you know, to really be honest about what you're going through would, you know, almost inevitably put you outside essentially the fold, right? You know, if you're honest about your spiritual doubts about, you know, whether or not you believe in, you know, the veracity of every aspect of the faith, or even if you believe in, you know, the practice of celibacy before marriage, or, you know, we're human beings, our beliefs, our ideas, our thoughts fluctuate and change. But to be honest about that inside a conservative religious community, I think of any kind, is dangerous because you risk, you know, being pushed out. And when you've made a life within this community, this is where your friends are, this is where your family is, this is where your identity is. It's terrifying. You know, so you have to choose between, am I going to be honest about myself and what I believe and what I think and who I am, or am I going to stay in my community? You know, and that's just, like I said, I think it's a heartbreaking choice that people have to make.
So
I wish it wasn't like that.
Yeah. So you moved to Texas with your then boyfriend, now husband. You all worked in a variety of spaces as musicians. You took a trip overseas and did some missionary work. At what point do you feel like you began to have some questions and some doubts, and how did your evolving sense of feminism play into that?
I thought I brought my feminism with me into Christianity. I was raised by a single mother in New York, you know, a liberal Democrat. It was just my birthright. And I thought that, you know, surely the church has progressed. And I was very naive to think that. So, you know, as I was kind of walking through this life of serving churches as a music minister, I, again, was hiding that part of myself. I was introduced to the idea that the word feminism can be offensive to people. I mean, I had never, you know, as a kid growing up in New York, as a young woman in, on the East Coast, I'd never heard that. I didn't know that that was a thing. But in conservative, you know, Christian communities, like, it was almost a bad word. So I think it started to shift for me. I started to get the sense that, you know, this part of me was going to need to be expressed, and in order to stay sane and stay true to myself, kind of, you know, after just years of, you know, sort of being passed over in terms of leadership opportunities, you know, having my ideas kind of not taken seriously, I thought, you know, that I was going to work from inside the culture to change it. Again, you know, naively, I thought, you know, I'm a leader, I'm a woman, you know, surely if I can do this and these people in my community see that, then it will change their mind. So when I, you know, we were overseas working as missionaries, I had, I think, probably a more upfront, close look at traditional gender roles. It was more, even more pronounced in the missionary community where, you know, missionary couples in the field, very, very, I mean, 100% of the time, the mother, the woman was at home with the kids, often homeschooling the kids, and the husband was, you know, out doing the work, you know, evangelizing, talking to people, building relationships. And in my marriage and in my partnership with my husband, you know, I was a total equal partner. I was singing on the microphone. I was out forming relationships. And I felt this just incredible tension that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. I wasn't at home with my toddler enough, and I also wasn't out in the field working enough. It was an impossible equation to solve. So, you know, it slowly became clear that that my feminism was not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually, you know, it did sort of push me out.
So how did you actually leave, and what kind of response did you get from your community, this really strong community and network that you had built as you kind of pulled away and began to question your faith a bit more?
I was, you know, sort of in a way that I look back on now as being, you know, a little reckless, but I was starting to introduce kind of what I was going through into conversations with people from this mega church that I was serving. You know, I remember having a coffee with a woman who was also a worship leader, and saying, you know, I don't know that I believe in this story, you know, of Jesus and, you know, the virgin birth and all of the specifics of the story. I don't know if I believe it all the time. You know, I think sometimes I believe it. And she was just, you know, utterly shocked that I said that. But I think that I was trying to just see, like, who was safe and who I could be myself with and be honest with. So as far as how did I find my way out, I mean, that particular job that I was doing, I was leading a service that was very, you know, very dramatically presented. There was a smoke and light show. It was as if you were walking into a nightclub. This is the way that the church wanted the service to be produced. And it was struggling. The service was struggling. It wasn't growing in the way that the you know, I guess the leadership wanted it to. And so eventually my pastor I was working for, who was a bit younger than myself, you know, told me that, you know, they had come to the decision that a woman couldn't do the job they needed, that because I was a woman, I couldn't lead that service. It wasn't working, and they were going to have to find a man to take over. So, I mean, so, you know, that was what pushed me out finally from that community. But I now I serve an Episcopal church. I'm very grateful for the Episcopal church for its, you know, progressive egalitarian theology. And, you know, so I'm not... You know, my story is not one of walking away from faith completely. It's a story of, you know, reimagining it and growing with it and finding finally a community that I can be my entire self in. And so I feel incredibly grateful that I've found that where I'm at now.
Cameron Deason Hammond is a musician and the author of This Is My Body, a memoir of religious and romantic obsession. Cameron, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Cameron will be in Chapel Hill on Friday at 6 p.m. at Flyleaf Books. You can find out more about those events and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.